Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOSLP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. I'm Livonia Mallory. I'm still on my couch.
I'm Guy Schaefer at my kitchen table. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first, Michelle Misurgeon speaks with Melanie Trimble of the Capital Region chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union about the pros and cons of police reform proposals put forth by the Albany Common Council. Then Andrea Cunliffe brings us the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market Autumn Report with Steve Ryder, who talks about autumn harvest and the winter move to Lansingburg. After that, Elizabeth Press speaks with influential feminist thinker Barbara Smith about the Biden-Harris administration's unique opportunity to name, confront, and end white supremacy. Then Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Ben Saraton speaks with organizers Jamela Anderson and Raquel Velio about the Upstate Mixtape, a new collection of tracks from artists in the Capital Region. And to close out the show, Russell Sage College student Brianna Burns brings her thoughts on the Roaring Twenties. But first, here are the headlines. Cuomo said that upstate sheriffs and police officials who don't enforce the new 10-person limit on Thanksgiving gatherings are violating their oaths and shouldn't hold the job. The Fulton County sheriff, who has gotten national attention over his defiance of the rule, later backtracked and said while his staff would not be going door to door to enforce the rule, he would respond to complaints. The governor has the power to remove sheriffs from office if they violate the order.
The bill that would ban the burning of AFFF at the Norlite incinerator was finally sent to the governor's desk last week for him to sign or veto. He has until Monday to decide.
10 years ago, Governor Cuomo agreed to allow the Senate Republicans to draw the boundaries for Senate districts in ways that were designed to keep them in power, despite being greatly outnumbered by Democratic voters statewide, in exchange for an agreement to create the nonpartisan commission process to redraw congressional and state legislative lines after the 2020 census. Critics said that the process agreed to would still be dominated by partisan politics and likely lead to gridlock. The Times Union reports that such fears are being realized in the early work of the new commission.
Counties in the Capital District hope to finish counting absentee ballots by Thanksgiving, a little more than 3 weeks after the election. In the 19th Congressional District, Republican challenger Cal Vanderwater finally conceded yesterday to incumbent Antonio Delgado. Meanwhile, in Washington, sitting President Donald Trump has refused to concede to President-elect Joe Biden, despite no evidence of massive voter fraud or losing numerous legal challenges. Trump is now trying to convince Republican-controlled legislators to ignore the votes and instead award the state's electoral delegates to him instead. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's @mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390, that's 518-272-2390. Melanie Trimble, with the Capital Region chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union, speaks about the pros and cons of the police reform proposals put forth by the Albany Common Council, with Michelle Misurgeon, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Good day, all. This is Michelle Misurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, and my guest today is Melanie Trimble with the Capital Region chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Welcome, Melanie.
Thank you.
So the Albany chapter of the NYCLU has been advocating for meaningful civilian oversight of police agencies in Albany and Schenectady to address serious persistent allegations of police misconduct and corruption. And back in August this year, Albany implemented a policing reform and reinvention collaborative in response to the executive order from the governor, and the policing reform collaborative has been tasked with compiling recommendations to go to the Albany Common Council of April of next year. In the meantime, the Albany Common Council has come up with some of its own proposed legislation, and I wanted to capture your thoughts on the proposed legislation, the pros and cons. So can we start with Local Law H, which requires a gathering and reporting of statistics?
Right. Well, we're very pleased that the city is taking the directive from the governor seriously and really rethinking the police department. But a lot of these proposals don't really have a robust look at how to police to really protect the community and be a part of the community. Local Law H requires the reporting of, it's very important. Data collection is key in being able to rein in a department and take a really long, hard look at what they're actually doing. But it doesn't include warning citations and arrests. So we're a little concerned about little minutiae within that law to not be as broadly interpreted as possible. So instead of just traffic violations, what if you're just walking down the street? It's not a traffic violation, but you get stopped by the police. We would like that to be included in the statistics.
So the next local law is the implementation of using city-owned body or dashboard cameras by the police, and also reporting when the cameras are turned off.
Right. Our concern with body cameras, and we did work with Albany's police department on its creation of its body camera policy. The biggest problem with body camera footage is who's entitled to see the footage. And unfortunately, in most cases, police departments are in complete control of the footage, and it is rarely released to the public. I mean, it really depends upon the temperament of the police chief who makes those decisions, and those circumstances can change if personnel changes. So we'd like to see it memorialized in any legislation that the public has access to things that are recorded on the body cameras. And also there are other departments around the Capital Region that don't have very strong body camera policies. It's imperative that the officers turn them on, do not have control of turning them off until the stop is completed. And, you know, to respect people's privacy, of course, there are times, say, during a domestic violence incident where the camera shouldn't be turned on. But those things are very discreetly outlined in camera policies. And we'd like to make sure that not only Albany's policy, but the policies of other police departments in the Capital Region.
Okay, and the third was Local Law J, which really is enhancing the Community Police Review Board in the City of Albany, their authority and ability to exercise oversight, review, and resolution of community complaints, basically creating a more meaningful citizen review.
Yeah, there are really some good ideal models out there for citizen police review boards, and almost all of them include subpoena power, and we're very happy to hear that the Common Council is seriously considering granting that ability for the board to independently issue subpoenas, because right now they have the power to issue them, but with the permission of the Common Council. And again, political circumstances could change. The council met now may be very willing to issue subpoenas in a police situation that really warrants it. However, the politics can change. And so we want it memorialized in the legislation that controls the Citizens Police Review Board, that they do have independent investigations and subpoena power. The other thing is they really need an independent counsel. I don't think that that's included in Local Law J. And that is essential for the Citizens Police Review Board to have independence from the police department when making legal decisions. And right now, the Citizens Police Review Board has to rely on the same attorneys that serve the police department. That's not going to work. You know.
And I understand sometimes it's even difficult for the Community Police Review Board, even when they ask for information, to get it released from the police. It could be like they kind of have to jump through hoops.
Well, part of the shielding was involved with 50A, which is state legislation that shielded police officers from having their personnel records looked at. And that often has, has impeded the Citizen Police Review Board's ability to make sure the police officers aren't continually doing bad things and without any kind of recourse on the police department. We need to know as a public what's happening with disciplinary records within the department. And we're very pleased with the repeal of 50A to start to really work with the courts and the police departments to get as much information out to the public as is necessary for them to have oversight over the police departments that control their very lives. We're very excited. We actually have begun to send in FOIL requests to many police departments in the area. In our area, we're looking at Troy Police, at Schenectady Police, and at the State Police. So we're hoping to get a full, robust collection of personnel records out of them. We'd like to have the courts enter into it and make decisions about what the limits will be on that. That's in particular the Schenectady lawsuit. So we'll see what happens with the release of 50A information, and also I think it will help the Police Review Board deliver and deliberate in a better manner to serve the public.
There was a November 10th symposium through the New York Writers Institute, and when asked about systemic racism, Troy Police Chief Brian Owens said that, quote, "We don't have systemic racism in the Troy Police Department," unquote. So how do you think communities can come together to make improvements and reform when those in law enforcement reject the idea of systemic racism in law enforcement?
Well, and that's exactly why most police departments, hopefully the Troy Police Department will follow suit, are conducting audits to look at the data that they already have and see if, in fact, it's indicating that discriminatory arrests are being made, or that they're that at least show us how many and what's happening in our neighborhood are people of color being involved in the criminal justice system at a much higher rate than the white population in cities that where their demographics don't indicate that's fair. So one thing is data collection. I mean, the Albany Police Department in its audit has fallen short of being able to even provide the data that the auditors can analyze. We're very concerned that the Troy Police Department isn't keeping records that are sufficient to do that kind of analysis well. Without that, the claim that there is no bias in the police department is just an empty statement, because we don't have the data to show whether or not a police department is targeting people of color unnecessarily. So data collection is key. Everybody should look at the STAT Act. We've been trying to get that passed in New York State for a long time. It will require police departments to collect the type of data that the public needs to see in order to know how well they're performing within the communities they serve.
So we're kind of running out of time here. Is there anything else that you would like to see included in any of these police reform proposals? Is there anything missing?
Well, we have a mission statement that's on our website that I would recommend people go to. It's got a lot of points in it about what true police reform would look like. And that's working with the community to, be able to really have established trust among the people that the police are serving, and to really kind of de-escalate the militarization of our police departments and make them more humanistic and more responsive to the community. And so you can go to our website, nyclu.org, just look under policing, and you can find our mission statement there on police reform.
Okay, I hate to do this, but I have to wrap up. And I thank you very much, Melanie, for being with me today, and stay safe.
Yes, stay safe and healthy.
Okay, thank you. Right. And this is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Michelle Masurgeon speaking to Melanie Trimble of the Capital Region Chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
Next, Steve Ryder from the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market talks with HMM's Andrea Cunliffe about feeding the capital region with seasonal specialties from local food producers and farmers' winter harvests.
It's Andrea Cunliffe here from Hudson Mohawk Magazine speaking with Steve Ryder from the Troy Farmers Market. And we've got some changes coming.
Yes, we do. We have been trying to figure out how to do a winter market this year. Now we're faced with the situation of how do we deal with an indoor farmers market in a pandemic? So we've given that a lot of thought over the last couple months, and we do have some news and some new ideas, and we're looking forward to sharing them with you today.
But you're not going to be in the atrium any longer, not this winter anyway.
The atrium was really off the table quite early on. David Bryce and the Bryce Companies have been looking to redevelop the atrium. So we weren't really sure if we would be in there even if there hadn't been a pandemic. To be there, if it worked with his development plans and our ability to put something on in there. But I think pretty much early on we decided that it really was not going to be somewhere we could be during a pandemic. I mean, it's so tight in there when you look at how we functioned over the years, how many vendors are there, how we would create social distancing, you know, how we would get people in and out and around the atrium. So even though we kept it on the back burner as a place that we would try and work with if we had to, we were looking to find somewhere where we could really create good social distancing that had better air circulation, that, you know, had automatic doors like you would expect. And so we hunted high and low throughout Troy and came up with the potential of using the former Price Chopper up in Lansingburg.
That's a really interesting location out of central Troy. I mean, it's great because there's good space, but that's a bit further north.
Yeah, we did look at other sites too that were outside of central Troy, also even outside of Troy itself over in Colony. We looked at all the colleges. We talked with Hudson Valley and RPI and Russell Sage to see if they had spaces that might be used. We did a customer survey and found that, you know, the downtown location, although everybody loved it, was not necessarily essential for us to continue to have a market. And we needed to find a space that was big enough to be able to accommodate all of the requirements that retail has to work with these days under the governor's reopening plans. But we looked at other locations in malls and stuff, and we wanted to stay in Troy. And we've always had our eye on Lansingburg as a place where we might want to be trying something. So when we found out that the Price Chopper had closed last winter, we'd even looked at it as a possible place to do a midweek market this summer, and now we're turning to it as our location for the winter. You know, we're disappointed that we couldn't find somewhere downtown, but we have to support our vendors and find them a place which we can safely put on a market, and this is it. So we're going to head up into the Berg. If all the lights are in your favor and you're driving up from downtown, you can be there in less than 15 minutes. If you're coming from outside of Troy, you can, you know, use 787 up to the 112th Street Bridge. You can come over the 125th Street Bridge. You can drop down from Route 40 quite easily from the Brunswick, Melrose, Scaticoke area. So it's actually a good location. The only one big downside is it's not downtown. But we're only going to be there through the really cold winter months where we can't be outside. And then we'll be back outside again when April comes along.
Well, it's kind of nice to see that the market would have a satellite location maybe next summer when there's more flexibility. Is there a bus system that goes up there?
There's a bus system. We're looking to see how that would work. We've reached out to CDTA to talk about coordinating with them. But yeah, there's bus stops right outside. There's great parking right there. So there are some challenges that we have to face. The biggest issue that we're going to face is the capacity that we can have at any one time. With customers and vendors have to be below a certain number. So we're still playing around with exactly how that's going to work. And we don't intend to do the reservation system like we started at Russell Sage, but we might have to if it doesn't work out. But we're going to try and get people through really quickly, create a layout that allows people to shop.
going to the market, besides being able to find wonderful local farm fresh food and supporting your local industries or your local food industries, is almost a festival atmosphere. I mean, it's a lovely place to acknowledge your friends and your neighbors and talk to providers who give you ideas and suggestions for food and recipes. So maybe the bigger space will give you a little more accessibility to those kind of charming elements about the market.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it does offer to give that opportunity, but also, you know, we have to realize that in this day and age, it's really, you know, and we did it in the summer market too, is that we had the one-way system that really encouraged people to go through and find everybody, but do it in a way that did not leave you to linger. I mean, we have, it's you know, the time that we're at the festival will come back, but right now that's not that time. And we really do need to sort of cater to the needs of an essential shopping trip. I mean, we are going to be able to stay open during the pandemic when others are closing because we are an essential service. And hopefully that will remain the way it is. We're going to be treating ourselves just like a grocery store in that respect. And we do need to get people in and out. Yes, you'll be able to chat. And yes, you'll be able to linger, but maybe you'll be doing that outside. We want people to be able to come in with their masks on, keep their social distance, and get what they need to and move along so that other people can come in and we can get the most people through at any one time. So we will have the spacing between the vendor booths that we had outside.
How is the community of Lansingburg? How is that community accepting this? Are they happy? Are they pleased? Are they excited? I mean, it's got to be horrible to have an empty building sitting there and nothing going on. So this is probably an addition to what can happen to bring people into Lansingburg.
Yeah, I totally agree there. I mean, we haven't heard much because we haven't really done a full-blown announcement yet. We just put it out at the market on Saturday, and there were some people from the Berg who were dancing in the streets, so to speak. They were very happy with the thought that they were going to have a farmer's market really close to them. And I think that there's a lot of people in the Lansingburg area and also around in Waterford and over into Cohoes that will probably find the market for the first time, and hopefully will then come back downtown with us when we move back outside.
Or maybe you'd be able to keep a satellite up there in the summer.
Definitely something that we were looking to try and do, especially like the Wednesday market that we tried in downtown Troy. We were thinking we would try that this last year up in the Berg, and still we'll try and do that next year if we can.
When does this move take place?
Well, we are outside for the next two weekends. We'll be doing the Saturday market before Thanksgiving outside, and the weather forecast looks really good for this weekend, sunshine and 50s. So what a great time to come get all your Thanksgiving food from your local farmers. And then we will do our traditional after Thanksgiving market, and that will be outside too. Weather permitting, we'll see what happens. Hopefully we'll continue the fine spell of Saturdays. And then we move inside on December 5th. Yep, Saturday, December 5th, and we hope to have all of the vendors that want to go there to be there. We don't know exactly how many we'll have, but we're playing in the vicinity of between 50 and 75 vendors. The more vendors we have, the less customers we can have in there, because every vendor that we have counts against the capacity. So we have to balance that very carefully and make sure we have a good mix of the vendors that we're looking to have in there to create the environment that everybody wants to come shop at.
So what's in store? What's good this season?
Well, obviously there's some great fruit still. There's some great apples, and there's a lot of squash and potatoes and root vegetables coming. There's Brussels sprouts, which, Americans are still learning how to eat the Brussels sprouts. Brussels sprouts are everywhere. There's some really good side dishes that people can create. And I know that the Pikers has a good range of Thanksgiving sides that they're putting out. And then there's the beer, wine, and no beer at the moment, but wines and spirits are in great supply. And there's a lot of ciders and meads this year. We've got mead in the market for the first time. And then last couple weekends, Berry Patch has even had strawberries and raspberries. And I don't know if they'll manage to survive the frost out there this week to do it again this weekend, but they had a lot that lasted till about 11 o'clock this last Saturday. So fresh strawberries in November, and also some tomatoes still that were out there. We do have a limited supply of chicken and others at the market. But we have two ways that, you know, you or three ways. First of all, you come to the market and you shop. The second way is you can always reach out to your favorite vendor and find out what they have and pre-order it, and they'll bring it and have it put by for you. And then the third way, obviously, is to use our online market, which has been a great success over the summer with people who don't feel like they can come to the market, don't want to risk the health issues that they perceive at grocery stores and in person at the market. And so we do have our online market where you order, pre-order by a Thursday and pick up on a Sunday over at Cariota's in Green Island. And that's going to continue full throttle during the winter. So if the price chopper is a little too risky for you and it doesn't, you know, isn't working out convenience wise, then order online and pick up. We aggregate and deliver right to your vehicle on a Sunday.
The market is so crucial to the whole area, not only for regional farmers and producers, to be able to give essential, fresh, healthy food. So many residents who rely on that. It's really a Troy Waterfront Market, which is now still on the waterfront.
That's right. We're still down there, right there. We're back on the waterfront.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you very much.
That was HMM correspondent and Andrea Cumliffe speaking with Steve Ryder from the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community, and it is supported by independent donations. Thank you all, and we thank our volunteers and our sanctuary sustainers. You can hear all about our stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org. In her recent op-ed in the Boston Globe, Barbara Smith says that the start of the Biden-Harris administration would be the ideal time to attempt something that has never been done before. Name, confront, and in white supremacy. WOOC producer Elizabeth Press speaks with Barbara Smith about her continued effort to engage the public on topics of white supremacy and systemic racism.
Today, we are joined by Barbara Smith, author and independent scholar who has been active in the movement for social, racial, and economic justice since the 1960s. She is here today to talk post-elections. Barbara Smith, welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much.
So you wrote an op-ed for the Boston Globe called What Joe Biden Should Say About White Supremacy. And in a creative way, you wrote the kind of speech that you would hope he might be able to give in his first weeks as president. So I was hoping you could start off by reading the words you could imagine or in a fantasy world see coming out of President-elect Joe Biden's mouth.
Of course. So this is not the very beginning of the op-ed, but it's a section that I think will tell everyone who is listening the flavor of what I was trying to do in the op-ed. So he begins by talking about why he decided to run for office, and it is widely known that he decided to run for president because of what happened in Charlottesville in 2017. And then he says, in recent weeks, however, I have become aware that the situation of racial injustice that the nation faces is even more urgent and complex than I had previously believed. I now understand that what we face is not merely racial discrimination or even systemic racism, but institutionalized white supremacy. I know that some folks may not like the term systemic white supremacy because they see it as an attack on white people. I wondered about that too, but I found out that it does not primarily refer to individual attitudes or behaviors, but to a powerful, entrenched system that consistently disadvantages people of color and privileges whites. When we talk about racism, we usually focus on race relations, how different kinds of people do or do not get along. Challenging individual bigotry is critical, but we have a much larger task. We need to look at the impact of systemic white supremacy on all aspects of American life. It is time to stop playing around the edges of this problem and to fix it. Here are some of the actions my administration will take in the first 100 days. I will appoint a racial justice czar who will oversee all governmental actions to address systemic white supremacy. I will engage in open dialogue with leaders who call for defunding or abolishing the police to better understand their recommendations for transforming our criminal justice system. My administration will explore initiating a truth and reconciliation process in consultation with countries such as Germany, South Africa, and Rwanda. And it goes on like that.
So much comes to mind when hearing you read the speech that you made up that President-elect Joe Biden could give on his first week in office. I'm wondering, what motivated you to write this op-ed in this way?
My editor at the Boston Globe, and I love saying my editor at the Boston Globe because we did not know each other until I wrote my first op-ed for the Boston Globe back in June, which is titled, "The Problem is White Supremacy." She contacted me the week before the election, and she asked if I would write an op-ed about white supremacy. She specifically said, could you write about white supremacy in relationship to the election for our post-election coverage? And if Joe Biden wins, what should he do? And then the other possibility was, if the other one wins, and I don't call his name, if the other one wins, will that embolden white supremacists? And so I, you know, was emailing back and forth with her. I said, well, you know, that's actually two articles that you're asking me possibly to write. I said, well, I'm only going to write one. I'm going to write the one with the better outcome, which is to have that creature removed. Although, of course, he's in deep denial and creating chaos and death as a result of not allowing the process, the basic processes of a transition to go forward. But anyway, I decided not to waste any time writing about him and that. And I thought, if the worst happens, I can just rage write. You know, I can rage write something or either decide not to write anything at all. So I wrote what I've already begun to share and that we're talking about with this op-ed, this fictionalized speech. Originally, I thought, let me write a letter to Biden. That's how I started out. And then not very far into it, a day or two into it, and I had very little time for me because I am not a quick writer. But in any event, I thought not long after I'd started, I said, what about writing a speech for him? And I just loved the idea because that's a very powerful thing to do, to put words into someone's mouth.
Some of these recommendations here touch us closer to home as well. We just had this series, The Time for Reckoning, where different city officials in Troy, Schenectady, and Albany got together, and then community members got together and responded. And here in Troy, we heard Chief Brian Owen say that within the Troy Police Department, he does not believe we have racism. And he also said that systemic racism does not exist within Troy's police department. I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of how, you know, we start to, as you say, name, confront, and end white supremacy.
There's always like more than one goal that I have in writing what is now a series of articles about white supremacy. And I'm not saying I'm going to write another one, but there are now three. One of my goals for this one, as with the others, is to enlighten people and to inform them about how white supremacy functions. So besides the kind of in-your-face tactic of writing a speech for this most powerful person on earth, I also had the goal of, let's have an explanation yet again of how white supremacy functions so people can get that out of the article too. And I do want to comment on this incredibly fake news concept of there being no racism and the Troy Police Department and no systemic racism, etc. It's not about the Troy Police Department, although that is something that we need to be gravely concerned about. To say that there's no racism in an American institution is to be talking nonsense. That's the point that I'm trying to make and have been trying to make ever since the late spring, which is that, as Trevor Noah said so cleverly, he said racism in our society is like corn syrup. It's in everything. And I completely agree. And that's exactly what I've been trying to convey. It is really, to me, unethical to be putting out that perspective when those of us who are the target of this oppression know absolutely without question that we are the victims and the survivors of the reality of systemic racism. It is so disrespectful to us and to our experience. Thevenin, I mean, please, you know, let's just be real. But obviously, people don't like to be real when it comes to a race in the United States.
As you write an op-ed like this, as you write this, you know, fictitious speech for President-elect Biden, what do you hope a reader takes away from this in their own life, in their own activism, in their own work?
What I want readers to take away from this piece and from others that I've written like over a lifetime is that much is possible if we envision it and if we put our energy, our collective energy, into making it so. It's like kind of writing to inspire. Is writing to inform, absolutely to inform. His speech does a good, short, and concise description of what white supremacy is and how it functions. But it's also to say, yeah, we could have that. Why don't we have that? Let's have that. How do we get there? And the op-ed ends with me talking about what I always talk about, which is that it's the people on the ground doing the work and the organizing. Those are the people who make these visions real. You know, more fight, more energy, more really smart strategies, because it's really important to be strategic.
Excellent. Barbara Smith, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much.
To read Barbara Smith's opinion piece called What Joe Biden Should Say About White Supremacy, visit the Boston Globe.
There's a new collection of tracks by artists local to the Albany-Troy region. It's called the Upstate Mixtape, and the first volume was just released on November 15th. It's a compilation that's diverse in genre, with songs running the gamut from funk to rap to ambient folk. It's also diverse in the identities of the curated musicians, and proceeds from sales of the album are distributed back to Black contributors as a form of reparations. HMM correspondent Ben Sarriton speaks with organizers Jamela Anderson and Raquel Velio about the project, the local music scene, and the free food fridge in Albany.
Upstate Mixtape Volume 1 is here, a new benefit compilation of music from the Albany-Troy area. Right now you're hearing Take a Dive by The Age, one of the featured tracks. I spoke with the mixtape's organizers over Zoom about how the project came to be, how musicians can perform reparations, and diversity in the local music scene. Welcome, everyone. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, brought to you by the Sanctuary for Independent Media. My name is Ben Sarriton. I'm talking today with two local organizers who have put together a really interesting musical project. Could you two please introduce yourselves and let us know who you are?
So my name is Jamela Anderson. I am a yoga teacher, a doula, a community organizer slash activist, and I am the founder of the Free Food Fridge, Albany.
I'm Raquel Velio. I sometimes don't really know who I am. I'm a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute as an actual daytime job, but I've been a local musician for the past 2 years, and yeah, just got involved with the music scene around here.
Well, we're here to talk today about the Upstate Mixtape Volume 1, which just came out. It was just released on Bandcamp. Could the two of you describe what the Upstate Mixtape is and what its aims are?
Sure. For the past like 7 or 8 months, I've been doing fundraising. And this was sort of like Raquel's like brainchild, which she brought to me, knowing what I've been doing and how I've been collaborating with a bunch of different people in the area, trying to keep like the fundraisers and like the mutual aid fund sort of like having like several different ways to raise money. So it's not just like the same thing over and over again, and to keep it kind of fun for people, especially during like this trying time. And since Raquel is a musician, this was like right up her alley. We weren't really sure, I think, at first what it was going to be like and what we were going to do. But then once we like actually sat down and like put pen to paper, it was like, oh, okay, like let's get all these artists and we'll have like, you know, not just like BIPOC artists, but artists that are sort of like within the community and that support other BIPOC artists. And so then we can have like maybe a little bit bigger of a reach with like the people who will actually be able to listen to it and their networks and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And I remember the day that I realized that this might be something interesting was actually one of my friends in who's a member of the or part of the London music scene in the United Kingdom. And she put together a mixtape fundraiser for the National Health Services over there. And I was like, oh, right. That's something that people can do as well, is like buy music and that money can go to different causes. And seeing all of the incredible work that Jamela has been doing and being in the music scene for the past 2 years and seeing how a lot of spaces are overwhelmingly white in ways that made me really uncomfortable. I thought that this was one way to really redistribute funds to Black artists and a way to amplify Black voices with the white musicians who contributed to it, contributing their tracks as a form of reparations.
Definitely something I wanted to ask you about today. Reparations is a term that's been used in the social media posts and marketing and writing about this release. I wonder if you could speak more generally about what reparations are for maybe listeners who aren't familiar with how they function in today's world. And I just want to hear your thoughts on how it works kind of in this music realm.
Yeah. So that's like, it's kind of hard to like put that like reparations into like a small, like little uniform, because it's like so big and so deep rooted. So reparations being that, money goes back to Black Indigenous people of color, so that they have, you know, because of systemic oppression and racism and just the barriers that have been put in place to keep Black and Brown and Indigenous people from being able to get to the same place as maybe white people or white folks. So this is like, in this specific case, this being reparations, is that there are some artists that we know that do have a big following, and there might be some Black artists that might not have as big of a following and some that do. And so it's like, using their following and their energy and their time like as reparations in this specific thing. So then the money going back to the artist, like people are just like, it's like a donation. So you're like not necessarily donating money as the white artist, but you're donating all these other things. And then we're able to then give more money back to the Black artist to then amplify their own projects that they're doing to get up, you know, off the ground, or to just put more money to keep elevating their music and keep getting it out there.
The compilation itself is really diverse. I mean, it goes in a lot of different directions. There's some ambient guitar work, there's some hip hop. How exactly did you curate this? And, you know, who are the people on the mixtape? Maybe you can give us a rundown.
So as far as the diversity goes, I think it actually reflects the diversity of music being created around here. It's true for all music scenes that we just have a variety of sounds, and we have a tendency of grouping music with like. And if we're going to do a mixtape that represents a region, I think that would be a huge mistake to just try and create this as though the only thing that existed locally were like folk artists, because that's not what exists locally alone. So we tried to bring in as diverse of a group as we could musically to really show the diversity of music we have in the region.
Even within just like Black artists, and like not pigeonholing Black artists into a specific type of music, which is like something that I've experienced just being on like the periphery of the music scene for so long and having so many friends that are musicians, is that, you know, people are always trying to relate different Black artists in the area to like someone else who's another Black artist that might be famous. And that to me is like a form of racism and oppression. Like people are, especially Black people, are allowed to make music that doesn't fit into any sort of box or criteria. So this was also to be like, hey, like Black artists are multifaceted, and that we aren't giving, we aren't like allowing people to just be like genre nonconforming. Like we're trying to like make it so that, oh, if you're Black, you play this type of music. Oh, if you're, you know, this type of way, if your voice sounds smooth and sultry, then you're this type. And it's like, no, like you can be all of those things. So like, even within just like the Black artists that we use, it was super diverse. And that was like really, really important for us to do for this project.
Absolutely. I think one thing that emerges as a listener to this is that you actually don't know just from the description or the listing or the MP3s, who's Black, who's white, who's what, and who's in each ensemble. So it's this interesting, I mean, race is centered at the compilation, but it's not necessarily centered as a listening experience. I think that's a really huge accomplishment.
Thanks. That really means a lot. I think that that does go to the heart of what we wanted this compilation to do.
Jamela, you're very involved in a lot of other community support and direct action initiatives. It's really nice to see this kind of nestled among other efforts to inform and educate the community and change things. I wonder if you can tell the listeners how they can support this project. Well, obviously, they can go purchase it on Bandcamp. It's at upstatemixtape.bandcamp.com. But besides just listening and purchasing this record, are there any other initiatives that people can support or get involved with that you want to let them know about?
I think that one of the biggest things for support, obviously, like, you know, buy the album, but also like listen to the people's music. Like this is supposed to be just like a little sip, you know, like this is supposed to be the tip of the iceberg for these artists. And like, not that we're getting them any more recognition than they might already have, but it's just like, even if one other person listens to them, like it could be a gig in the future. It could be like someone asking someone to do the background music for like a short film. Like we have filmmakers like right here in like upstate New York that people like want to work with local artists, but they have, you know, they're just always fishing from the same pond, and like this might open up the doors for that. And even if it's not immediate, it's like in the future. Just listen, give people a chance, and like know that these artists, like what they gave us is not how all of their music sounds. So like you might find a new artist that you really love and that you like and that you want to work with.
So yeah, is there anything else you want listeners to know?
I just want to give a shout out to Jade Warwick, Trash Kid Art, who did the incredible artwork for our mixtape, and honestly it looks awesome, and she's the reason why it looks as good as it does, and I'm really grateful for her work.
Could you please just give a quick rundown for the listeners of what other community organizing efforts you're currently running?
The efforts that I have going on right now, more specifically, are the Free Food Fridge, which is a circuit of fridges in the Capital Region for folks who are houseless or in underserved neighborhoods and so on and so forth, that are able to just go to these fridges and take food 24/7. And it's like fresh and healthy foods, and restaurants and farms and grocery stores donate. So that's like the biggest project I have right now. My other efforts are like the other parts of my mutual aid are raising money for the Black and Brown community, and more recently adding like the queer community into it, because there are a lot of like queer folks who are having a hard time, and like, you know, just it's obviously intersectional work, so there's a lot of intersections in that within the queer and Black community specifically. And I've raised like around $160,000 in the past 7 or 8 months, so I'm not gonna stop.
Amazing. That might be a great note to end it on, actually.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
Hello. My name is Brianna Burns. I'm a senior at Russell Sage.
That was HMM Ben Saratan speaking to Jamela Anderson and Raquel Voyo, organizers of the Upstate Mixtape. You can learn more about the album at upstatemixtape.bandcamp.org. That's bandcamp.org.
To close out the show, Russell Sage College senior Brianna Burns brings us her reflections on class, race, and urbanization in the Roaring Twenties.
Hello, my name is Brianna Burns. I'm a senior at Russell Sage College. I'm double majoring in English and childhood education. This is my last semester, and I am currently enrolled in a course called The Roaring Twenties, and it talks about and reveals some social issues of the 20s, the construct of the new world, class differences, and how it contributes and is kind of connected to larger issues around race, displacement, urbanization, suburbanization, and a disenfranchisement of the have-nots that kind of separates them from the haves. I mean, there's many other topics that we discuss in the class, but these are the ones that I'm focusing on particularly. So I want to emphasize how literature changes or contributes to our understanding of these issues and gives us a glimpse into the origin of the separation or the segregation amongst economic and social classes, racial classes as well. I recently read in an article in the Times Union that was titled Study, Albany, One of the Worst Cities in the U.S. for Racial Economic Inclusion, and the subtitle read, Albany, High in Disparities in Education, Home Ownership, and Income Compared with Other Cities. And this kind of got me thinking about some of the intentional decisions made and implemented that created such a large gap in the economic statuses in upstate New York, and how geographical factors coupled with intergenerational trauma due to years of oppression and disenfranchisement of minority groups are related to violent crimes. So according to the Office of Policy Development and Research, which is a research organization developed through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, neighborhoods' incidence of violence crime is related to an array of intertwined characteristics, including poverty, segregation and inequality, collective efficacy, disorder, trust in institutions, job access, immigration, residential instability, foreclosures, vacancy rates, and evictions. That is a lot to unpack. So basically, that one's living condition relates largely to the economic status and access to security, safety, and quality education. I'm no sociologist, but some might argue that conditions can be associated with rage and frustration and can lead to violence. The text I'm going to be looking at is an excerpt from Anzia Yuzerska, and it's titled The Lost Beautifulness. It's one of the very first readings that we read within the class. And this text highlights some of the consequences of what being economically poor and displaced can look like starting from the 1920s. And I think that it can be a framework for understanding connections of anger and outrage through the lens of immigrants being placed in tenements. So in The Lost Beautifulness, Yuzerska writes, she shrank in upon herself as though to ward off the raised whip of her prosecutor. You know how I feel? Her voice came from the terrified depths of her. It's as if the landlord pushed her in a corner and said to me, I want money, or I'll squeeze from you your life. I have no money, so he takes my life. This part of the excerpt is a result of a landlord having no regard for a woman who rents from his property, as he hikes up the rent simply because he can, and there's no protection for lower class or for anyone who doesn't fit the white middle class or upper class criteria at this time. This can be associated with some of the issues of homelessness and displacement that sits in the front of the minds of the people who are fighting to make ends meet in low-income communities we see today, and what fear and lack of safety one must feel when the worry of where they will sleep hangs over their head. Yuzerska continues, with savage fury, she seized the chopping axe and began to scratch down the paint. Breaking the plaster on the wall, she tore up the floorboards. She unscrewed the gas jets, turned on the gas full force so as to blacken the white painted ceiling. The night through, she raged with the frenzy of destruction. She, who Yuzerska is referring to, is a frustrated, angry woman who is being put out into the streets because she can't afford her raised rent. She's an immigrant, she is lower class, and she's a woman, and she lives in a tenement, defined by Carbon Negro, the managing research librarian, in an article titled Tenement Homes, The Outside Legacy of New York's Notoriously Cramped Apartment, in the New York Public Library. She defines it as single-family homes with the usually substandard and small living quarters leased to the poor. Now, this got me thinking about some of the direct connections between housing and violence that seems to be missed or not discussed in the highlights of our local news stations. How land use and racial segregation is neglected, but is the very same thing that marinates anguish amongst vexation. Is design a detail that needs to be investigated? Does built environment increase violence? While the Office of Policy Development and Research says that variations in levels of violent crimes are linked to complex characteristics of neighborhoods, including disadvantage, segregation, land use, social control, social capital, and social trust, as well as characteristics of nearby neighborhoods. While there are many factors that subscribe to the disparities in low-income communities, could we concede that in many ways anger fuels our actions? Not to make concessions for violent behaviors because it's inexcusable, but to develop an understanding on the layered components of the intersectionality between local economic status and racial segregation. I'm open to considering those possibilities. And even with some of the recent violence that we see in Albany and Troy, is implicit in the direct connections between low-income housing, survival, and violence. Violence lowers property value, low property value equals low tax outpour, and low tax outpour provides less resources in education and funding for extracurricular activities that can reduce violence and gang membership. The U.S. Department of Justice identifies that studies show that commonly identified family risk factors for gang membership include family poverty, check, other gang members in the family, check, poor parental monitoring, check, and a non-two-parent structure or changes in caregivers. It's a rabbit hole that has continuously spiraled, beginning as far back as slavery. Tori DeAngelis from the American Psychological Association writes, researchers have been assessing anxiety, depression, and PTSD in trauma survivors and their progeny, with Holocaust survivors and their children the most widely studied in over the longest period of time. It would be amiss for us to not think that this applies to low-income communities with high crime rates. Children are losing parents and friends, and they're witnessing the murders of their loved ones right before their eyes. There must be some type of critical and lasting effect that's left on their subconscious, if not their conscious mind, from the time they wake up in the morning until the time that they go to bed. The anxiety and fear they must feel walking outside, or even worse, the numbness that creeps up on them after the third or fourth time that they're experiencing this grief, what must brew up inside of them when survival is the only way they know how to live, what you're willing to do or participate in to feel protected by your peers or provide for your family when you feel hopeless and your resources are scarce. The Office of Policy Development and Research also writes, at a large level, children who live in neighborhoods with higher crime rates for 20 years experience significant reductions in income as adults. And so, the cycle continues, largely in part due to racial segregation and minorities getting the short end of the stick, for the most part, it being blacks and Hispanics and not excluding immigrant minorities like we saw in The Lost Beautifulness. Not much really has changed, has it? Renaming tenements and, I quote, housing, I'm using air quotes by the way, doesn't do much for the people who are the victims of poverty. We can say the old pull yourself up by the bootstraps saying, but the design of chronic poverty is all too relevant when you throw lack of opportunities, redlining, generational trauma, and PTSD into the pot, isn't it? Solutions, you ask? HUD suggests investing in communities caught in cycles of crime, decay, and disinvestment can help reduce crime rates. I agree. Investments create better resources and opportunities. It gives children options. And maybe stop compiling a bunch of low-income properties in one area, creating a large, dense pool of people who are trying to survive in close proximity. This also allows low-income families to attend schools that have more resources, and thus they get a better education and opportunities become more attainable. There has to be more emphasis put on these neighborhoods so future generations have more room for growth. It's just strange. The connection between 1920s America that Yezierska discusses in The Lost Beautifulness and 2020 America we see today has a frighteningly close resemblance. Well, thank you for listening to my podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got some good insights. Come again.
That was Russell Sage College student Brianna Burns as part of a segment on the Roaring Twenties in 2020, where students examined social and cultural issues of the 1920s and how and whether things have changed a century later. It's part of an ongoing series.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Lavonia Mallory. Our engineer is Alexis Goldsmith. Yay! Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org and on our Facebook page at facebook.com/WOOC105.3 FM. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to the local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.